Hey guys, my name is Crystal Kenny, and I'm in love with creating. All things artistic and imagination involved. I'm an American girl who chased her creative dreams all the way to Paris, France, making a living using photography. This podcast takes you inside the stories of all the artsy folks I've met along the way and gives you that extra push to discover your creative gifts. The desire to create is deeply inside each and every one of us, and I give you the tools and inspiration to find a new way of living a more creative life. This is La Vie Creative, the podcast.
Today on the show, I interviewed Tanya Heath. She has changed the fashion world in a big way by creating the first line of shoes with interchangeable heels. You can change the design, the height, anything you want. We talk about how she came up with the idea and how it's changed her life. So welcome to the show, Tanya. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you very much, Crystal. It's fun to be here.
Now, you have revolutionized the fashion industry. I'm just going to jump right into it. I cannot believe that no one had created this before you. You created shoes where you can remove the heel, put different heels on, change the height of the heel, interchangeable. I want to know the whole story behind this. But first, I want to know, let's start from the beginning. What is your Paris story? How did you come here?
So my Paris story is I was working at Foreign Affairs and I was in the policy planning division, and my director was one of the rare women. So she was 44 years old and she was drop dead gorgeous and she was single. And when I was 24, this very nice French boy asked me to marry him. And for my group of friends, that was really young. And at that time, we were that first generation right out of school wanting to take over the world and go where no woman had gone before. And yeah. My friends were like, what are you doing? You can't get married. That's not the plan. And I remember just sitting with my director and she said, listen, Tanya, I'm 44. I live with four cats, a mom who's got Alzheimer's and doesn't really know who I am. And nobody's ever asked me to marry them. So she said, if somebody wants to marry you, just say yes and go for it. And then I said, but I'll lose my entire education. I'll lose my career. I'll have to start over again. And she said, listen, I think somebody like you is very resourceful and you'll make it. So it was really, a mix between somebody asked me to marry them and this director who had a lot of courage.
I love that she gave you that advice at such a young age, because in our early 20s, we're so lost and we think we know what we want and who we are, but also people can really affect that very easily just with some words, because we are very still defining what we want and who we are. So that was so kind of her to tell you that.
It was, especially when compared and contrasted to the reaction of my best friend at the time, who slapped me in the face and told me I was a sellout to women.
I think just because you get married doesn't mean you have to give up all your hopes and dreams.
I agree, but I think sometimes society makes the mistake of being too polarized and not realizing that in between the black and white, there's just a universe of nuance and that it's possible to simultaneously be several things.
Yeah, and we can have it all, people. Come on. Especially with the internet, there's so much more, there's so much more available, so many more connections, so many more things to sell. So I think the internet has really revolutionized how we can live as well, as far as doing what we want and connecting.
True.
So you're 24, you were heading in a completely different direction, and then you married a beautiful Frenchman and moved to Paris.
Correct. I couldn't speak French. And I'm dyslexic, so Alliance Française really wasn't working out for me. So what I did is I applied to be admitted into one of the French grandes écoles because I figured it was better to learn French with a baptism of fire. And to my astonishment, I got admitted into every school I'd applied to. And then I just chose to stay here in Paris because my husband was in the army at the time. So this is way back when you still had mandatory military service for all men. And I learned French in business school while doing my MBA.
That is crazy. You learned French in business school. Like, business school is hard enough on its own. And then learning French at the same time, like, you did well in school still. It wasn't too difficult.
Well, I can master any subject long enough to write the exam.
I love that. So then your career went into more of management and consulting. Is that correct?
I started in management consulting, but then I had, you know, my first child, and I couldn't travel because at the time I was working mostly in Holland, Denmark, and Egypt. So I couldn't travel because of my firstborn. And also as an expatriate, it's difficult to have children because you don't have your family and you don't have a support network. And also, I guess the last reason is my husband was already very much working in Africa. So I was sort of responsible for the home front. And then I had two other kids quite quickly. So I moved over to new technologies and private equity. And in the meantime, I was a professor at Centrale Paris, where I gave a course on disruptive innovation to third year engineers.
This is so different from what you are doing now.
Yeah.
Or maybe
not. Well, it isn't exactly, because my shoe with removable heels and multiple height heels is actually a technological innovation. However, if you look at the press on fashion tech is normally considered an application. So what's considered innovation in fashion is usually a new shade of blue, or passing from mini skirts to long skirts and back to mini skirts again. So fashion in a lot of ways is mostly about repackaging what already exists, especially now. So it's rare to have somebody who's created a complete new product. So for example, I sold 400,000 pairs of heels. That's a complete new product accessory that's never existed before.
400,000. Oh my goodness. From the conception, from the beginning of making your shoe line.
Yes, that's right. Because with each pair of shoes, most women will buy three pairs of heels. Most women will take one low pair, one medium pair, and one high heeled pair. Just so they can have a lot of versatility in that one pair of shoes. In fact, yesterday I had a client who bought two pairs of shoes and four pairs of heels. And that astonished me. And I asked her why she was doing it. And she told me she was clearing out her closet. So she said she'd become a minimalist. She couldn't she couldn't handle having stuff around anymore. And she said with these two pairs of shoes and four pairs of heels, she was able to replace about 20 pairs.
Wow. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's great for the environment in that way too, but I want to go back to, like, how did this even start? Because you're teaching, you're working in consulting, you're having these beautiful children. And then one day you just wake up and say, you know, I'm going to design shoes.
No, it had come the very first time I put on a pair of heels. It was for an office job back home in Ottawa. And I could barely walk. And I was thinking, what is this? Like, why? And then I just started thinking, you know, this is just so typical. We can put a man on the moon, you know, we can build high-speed trains, we can do so many things, but we can't make a shoe that does it all and does it all on women's terms. So I started becoming obsessive about how to make high heels comfortable. And I tried to do that for years, and I bought every product that was out there. So all of the gels, all of the Nike Air shoes, like all of the different concepts that came out. And in actual fact, none of those really work. So then I started thinking, truly the only way you can make a high heel comfortable is to make it occasionally not a high heel. And that's where the idea came from.
I love that. So like you came up with the idea while you were living in Paris, obviously. And once you had this idea, how difficult was it to get it going, like to find a designer, to find, you know, the factories? Like, how long did it take for you to have this idea to actually have a shoe in your hand?
So that was unbelievably difficult. So when I started this company, the only thing I knew was private equity. So I had private equity instincts, and I knew a lot about innovation. So what I tried to do was I tried to buy a previous patent, and I tried to use leverage to buy a factory in the south of France that made army boots. And I'm so happy that I did neither. So what I now know today is that a factory tooled to make army boots can never make a luxury pump. So that's number one. And number two, when I had examples of the technology, it was American technology that I tried to buy, and I did focus groups here in Paris. People were saying things like, I'd rather be dead than wear those shoes, or those shoes are so ugly, they look like a dead donkey. Like, the feedback was so overwhelmingly negative that I realized I would have to start from zero and build the concept myself. But to answer your question succinctly, it ended up taking 2.5 years to get from idea to proof of concept. It took 14 engineers and shoe designers. And because still to this day, everybody in the shoe industry thinks I'm a fraud, thinks the shoe is impossible, it was very difficult to convince people to even work with the brand. So for example, the first shoes that we did, that very first collection, I was charged 320 euros for each pair of shoes because the factory owner said, I'm happy to do it, but for me, it's just taking your money.
Wow. So no one believed in you.
Oh, and nobody, but it's still the case. I'm like this little lone voice who, you know, I don't get invited to the parties. If I do a trade fair, people still come to the stand to tell me I'm a liar. If I write to fashion press, they tell me things like, if this was possible, Christian Louboutin would have done it. I've had people even refuse to try them on.
What? So how, why do they think you're a liar? I mean, the shoe exists. It works. Like, what are you lying about?
I think it's so ingrained in people's ideas. It's so ingrained in people's psyche that this is impossible, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, you know, as a teacher of disruptive innovation, I anticipated this to a certain extent, maybe not to this extent, but one of the lesser known facts about Dyson is it took him 12 years to sell one vacuum cleaner.
Wow.
So people, you know, if you make an incremental improvement on a product, so say you come out with the first toothpaste that makes your breath smell good, your teeth whiter, and gets rid of cavities, you're selling that. But the first people who came out with toothpaste probably had a more difficult time.
Yeah, probably everyone was terrified of it.
Right. And you had to find a lot of arguments for making this a product. So I'm sort of, you know, this lone voice in the wilderness preaching something that everybody's been told is impossible.
That was actually my next question. Like, have any major brands approached you about buying your design, about buying your patent? It sounds like no.
No. However, the largest luxury company in the world asked me to be the CEO of their company and replace their top designer. I've had at the CEO level, an enormous amount of people tell me
no to that.
Sorry?
You said no to that?
Mm-hmm. I'm not there to sell handbags and lipstick. I think to a certain extent, anybody could do that. Or, you know, any smart person with an MBA can do that. But I'm here to change the world. Like, my goal is really to make women-friendly products with technology and innovation that fit into their life, and that are good for people and good for the planet. So I'm much more, I don't know if you would say an artist or an idealist. Certainly if I'd remained in Canada, I would be politically active. But because I'm in France, you know, I doubt anybody would ever vote for me. And this is my way of taking a stand on a lot of societal issues.
I love that. I mean, that's such a way to take a stand in France, fashion. And when you were hearing that, all these people telling you you're crazy, this is a terrible idea, these are ugly, these are horrible, blah, 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 blah. How did you continue? I mean, so many people suffer from like imposter syndrome or already having like low self-esteem, and you're completely making something new and people are not being super great about it. Like, how did you keep going and keep believing in yourself?
It was really hard. So, because they don't stop there. They tell you that you're unethical. They tell you that you're a liar. They tell you that you're ugly. They tell you that you're not one of them. My son said to me 4 years ago that he would never start a company because the only thing he'd ever seen of his mother's company was his mother coming home from work completely defeated and crying alone in her bedroom. So it's awful. My personality changed. So I used to be more, I don't think I was ever bubbly or outgoing, but I'm certainly introverted at the moment. Yeah. I don't trust people. And I almost never go out. So yeah, so it had, I guess, a lot of negative repercussions on me, on the company, certainly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're not networking and if you're not putting yourself out there, nobody really knows your company even exists. So it was a difficult period. I would say, to be honest, I've transcended that. So now I'm in a really good space. So, you know, on a happiness scale of 0 to 10, I'm probably at a 9. And I've had to build myself by myself on the only stable ground I know, which is me.
Yeah. I love that. So you just, you kept like believing in yourself, and even when other people didn't. Like, what about your family, your friends? Were they any kind of support for you, your husband?
No, but they weren't. I don't know if it's their fault. I work very hard. So I probably work 80 hours a week. And I'm also responsible for 3 children, one of who is, you know, she has very strong special needs. So I don't talk about my work when I'm not working, to the extent that a friend who I've known for 14 years saw me on TV 2 years ago. And she said, "I didn't even know you made shoes." Because if I go out, I don't ever talk about myself.
Oh, we got to work on that, girl. You can't be telling everybody about your stuff. You got to get your elevator pitch going.
No, I have an elevator. I won the French Tech Tour in 2006 for another company. But no, I can express what I when I'm out or when it's private time, I need to break from the company.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing is that, you know, the kind of support that you get as a creator in France is very different than you would get back home in Canada. So, for example, in Canada, every person I know, from my teachers to my friends to my doctor to everybody, has bought at least one pair of shoes and probably 10 to 20. In France, I only know 5 people who've bought a pair of shoes in the past 12 years.
Wow.
So yeah, that was Parisians do not support each other.
Yeah.
At all. So there's no point talking about it, really.
Yeah, yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. And it's like, if people want something, they want it, but just because it's like your friend or you, your doctor or whatever, they're not gonna like, "Oh, let me buy your shoes and support you." Like, they feel like it's the same. You're right. Like, Americans and Canadians are more supportive in that way. And I was wondering, like, who is the main buyer of your product? Is it French people, American? Like, who's the main buyer of these shoes?
The main buyer is definitely French people, simply because I got, you know, I won quite a few business competitions in the beginning. So we got a certain amount of publicity. And I did a client survey about 2 months ago, and I found out, to my astonishment, that 84% of the people who responded had heard about the brand from another friend. So we have an amazing word of mouth. In fact, the answer to, "Would you recommend this concept to somebody?" The answer was 98% who said that they would. And then to the answer to the question, "Would you be sad if the brand went out of business?" we got 99.8% of respondents who said yes.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really, I mean, you got some support then. It sounds like people are jumping on board. Is this where your happy scale jumped to a 9?
It was surprise, because it's really tough. So you know, my business due to COVID and strikes and gilets jaunes, you know, basically 4 years of instability has shrunk over 10 times.
Yeah.
So we're not even saying 10%. It's shrunk 10 times.
What's it like running a fashion-based business in France? Like, I know so many people dream of coming up with their own designer line, own dresses, own fashion purses, whatever. What is that like? Like, is that enjoyable? Is it constant struggles? How do you feel about running a business in France?
I think it's, you know, a mixture of the three. I think if you were to run a fashion business just about anywhere, it would be struggle. So I used to be very derisive about the fashion business when I was in software or when I was in new technology or when I was in diplomacy. But I would actually argue that it's probably one of the most difficult businesses in the world. So you have the first challenge of having to reconcile creativity with business. You have treasury cycles, which can last up to 3 years in between product conception and product sale. So for example, we're coming out with a brand new heel style in a few weeks, and I drew that heel 2 years ago. Obviously, the times are extended because of COVID delays, but you know, so you're engaged in a product for a very long period of time. Then there's so much about intuition. You have to get colors right. You have to get styles right. You have to be able to sniff out of the ether what people want. Then there's everything about marketing, publicity, sales, point of sale, merchandising, retail skills, communication, tone, brand building. So you've got this business that requires a much broader skill set than virtually anything I've ever seen in my life. I don't think there's anything that can compare to the amount of engaged risk that you have in fashion and the treasury requirements.
I can't even imagine. I mean, and also that has a lot of like trend forecasting involved too. Cause you know, if you design something 2 years ago, you're like, is this still going to be popular? Will this still be relevant? You know?
Yeah. And in fact, that's something where paradoxically, prior to having my own company, I was really good at that. But now that I have my own company, I'm terrified. So I rely a lot more on data than I used to when I was just a consumer. So when I was a consumer, my joke was that I could predict with more accuracy than a fashion editor or Karl Lagerfeld what was going to be popular. And now that I'm in the thick of the storm, so to speak, I'm much more insecure about my own ability.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess you have a lot more to lose too, because it's your money, it's your business.
It's not just that. If you look at what I do is I'm asking my clients to be creative. So I provide the base of a shoe, but we have 500 different heels and they're in different colors, different shapes, different textures, different. So my client has to, on the other end of their computer, choose a shoe and choose a few pairs of heels and believe that they've made a beautiful choice. So I have to always think like a client, because when I used to be in a retail environment, I realized very clearly that most people are highly insecure about creating their own products.
Interesting. That makes sense though.
So I have to think like somebody who's scared to do this. So for example, things that appeal to me very strongly, you won't necessarily find them in my collections, because even if somebody would like it in another brand where they're buying a shoe that's already attached to a heel, if they buy it in my brand and they have to put that heel on themselves, they need a lot more reassurance. Or 2 women out of 10, they really are Karl Lagerfeld. They just saunter into the boutique and they have so much self-confidence and such a strong view and definition of who they are and what they like, that for them, it's just pure pleasure.
That's so interesting. I mean, I love that how you've taken everything out of your wheelhouse and just combined it into this business and, you know, kind of had to break yourself down in a lot of ways to continue, you know, like work through those insecurities, work through, you know, what you know and what you don't know. Would you design all the patterns and looks, or do you work with other designers?
At first, I had a senior designer who was coming to us from the accessories section at Balmain, and he couldn't do it. So our first two collections ended up looking like elephant's feet. And it's because he fundamentally wasn't able to understand the technology. So now I design everything because I do understand the technology.
Wow. So you even do the designs. And like, what inspired your designs? Do you go somewhere and you see a color, or you take a trip and you see some kind of animal print or whatever? Like, how do you get the inspiration?
So in the beginning, because people kept on calling me a fraud, I was obsessed with reproducing iconic styles. So if, you know, if somebody had a pump, I wanted to have a pump. And I worked, this sounds silly, I worked for 3 years before we got our pump perfect, cut the same way a classical pump is cut. So that was incredibly difficult. The Mary Jane, which I love, so in our collection, it's called Tiggy. That took 3 years. You look at it, you would laugh your head off. Like, you would say, why is that such a difficult shoe? It just looks like a Mary Jane. But it was incredibly nitpicky and difficult to get right. So yeah, in the beginning, I was trying to do iconic styles. Then I moved on to the kind of shoes that people were asking for. And as I move forward, I won't be adding too many shoe styles, because I also deeply want people to consume less and wear more. So one of my criteria for a shoe design is you have to be able to wear it today and 10 years from now. So I avoid trends unless they become iconic. And I try to put the fashion in the heel. So at the moment, my heels are classical. So once again, I reproduced iconic heels. But now that that's done, the next heel that's coming out, which is named after my husband as a little homage for him putting up with me, so it'll be called Renault. This is our first total on-trend heel. And I've tried it with every single style of shoes because I have all of them here at home. So, you know, when I design a new heel, I have to make sure it looks good on things that we sold 6 and 7 years ago. So it looks great on all of the shoes that are already out there. And somebody who wants to update their look this summer can simply take sandals that they might have bought 5 years ago and add a new heel. And I deeply believe in that.
I think that's so in the right direction of where fashion's going too, because everything's going like, it went into stopping fast fashion and like veganism and, you know, helping the environment. It sounds like that aligns with your brand perfectly.
Well, it was a bit of a surprise, but I'd actually argue, and I know this will fall on deaf ears, because when we talk about sustainable fashion, we talk about using recycled materials or using Leather Trade Association leathers. And I do all of those things. So I do absolutely all of that. But I've also found a way of simultaneously drastically reducing how much footwear you consume and making tiny little pleasure purchases, kind of like a lipstick purchase, to update your wardrobe, but to still retain what you have. And in the sense of Tanya Heath Paris, my brand, you know, that collection takes on a real value. A person who has two or three pairs of shoes and six pairs of heels, there's virtually nowhere they can't go except for, you know, obviously a marathon and a hike. But you can get a lot of places.
Yeah. And how do you define creativity? I mean, obviously you are a very creative woman, but what is the definition of creativity to you?
I think as I've continued working and continued observing people, often, especially with us, because what we do is quite groundbreaking, I have to give people a blank piece of paper or a blank computer screen. And I've noticed that there's a lot of people who just can't go beyond that blank piece of paper and the blank screen. So I think that a creative person is somebody who is able to work with that blank piece of paper and that blank sheet and to do something completely new. And then I think a very creative person is somebody who loves doing that. And I do think there are people out there who are more comfortable with that blank sheet of paper. And then, you know, you've got your nth level of creativity. It's the people who transcend it and come out with something that's never been seen before.
The innovators. And what advice would you give to people who feel like they're not very creative, who are searching for their creative gifts? What would you tell them?
I would say creativity is just one of the skills out there, and it might not be the most essential. You know, perseverance is a skill. Honesty is a skill. Originality. There's a whole bunch of words that are sort of a tangent of creativity, which have as much value as creativity. So, you know, if you're not creative, don't sweat it. There's tons of people who are. Just focus on what you can do. That would be my advice. So I'm not, I mean, to a certain extent, I'm a fraud because I am a touche-à-tout. So in English, that means somebody who, I do like to try different things. And, you know, when I was in university, I would always joke about how I was a Renaissance man because I was still taking astrophysics in third year of international relations just to prove I could, not to the world, but, you know, to myself. Yeah. So I do like to have a veneer of knowledge, but not everybody's like that. And some people are specialized in what they do, and that's completely legitimate. And sometimes specialization, in fact, I'd argue often specialization can lead to creativity. So I think, you know, I guess the biggest advice I would have is don't sweat it and define creativity in a way that makes you creative.
I like that. And what's next for the brand? What's happening now? Anything new coming out?
Well, like I said, there's the new heel. I just received the summer collection, so I'm going to have to photograph it and start organizing all of the shoots for the summer collection. We're now going to be more standard, so we'll have an editorial line for each pair of shoes, and we'll be a bit more behaving like a fashion company. But my real preoccupation is, you know, save the company, renew with growth. So, you know, the big news is we came out of bankruptcy protection last week, and I'm super proud of myself.
Yes, congrats.
Yeah. So I was able to save everything. So, you know, that business degree did come in handy. And I got a standing ovation at the Tribunal de Commerce. So that was a bit of a rush. And now I want to focus on revamping sales and turning this company around and becoming what we used to be.
I love everything that's going on for you right now. And I can't wait to see what you do next. You remind me a lot of the, what's that woman who made Spanx? I always forget her name.
That is so funny you say that. I have clients, I don't know her name, but I have clients who spontaneously come into the store and tell me that. There's a few differences. I think she has a more bubbly, effervescent personality than me. And I think she's more, you have an American word for it. What do they say about people who are in New York? They're always on the make, or they're always.
Oh yeah. They're always like making connections, always like selling, like.
Yeah, there's a word for it that Americans use. I can't remember it, but I heard it a lot when I was in New York. I think she's one of those people. I'm not. You know, I'm a very, if we're in a party, you probably won't even know I'm there.
Yeah, but not even about her personality. It's about everyone thought her idea was horrible. They made fun of her. Nobody believed in it, you know, and she was the one that kept chugging along alone.
But she was selling almost immediately, and that's her personality.
Yeah, but I think you two would be best friends. Let's make you connect.
But no, she had a lot of courage because, you know, she just walked into her first point of sale and basically positioned her product near the cash register. And that to me is, you know, that's quintessentially American. And I wish I could be like that, but I'm not.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when I was a little bit, people told me I was ugly and to get out of their face. So, you know, it's kind of like asking a wounded animal to be something that she's fundamentally not. And that goes back to my advice about what would you say to people who don't feel they're creative? It would be to, you know, specialize in what you are good at and redefine creativity. At some point, I can't sweat the fact that I don't have this golden skill set. I have to just make do with what I have.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot to me. And I think that's a great note to end on. And where can people buy your shoes and follow you and connect with you?
Well, so they can find us online at www.tanyaheath.com. www.thefashionindustryhub.com. And they can follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
Perfect. I will add that to the show notes so people can check out your amazing designs, save the planet, look good, be comfortable. And thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you very much, Crystal.
Thanks so much for tuning in to La Vie Creative. You can find more information on missparisphoto.com. And if you enjoyed this show, please feel free to share and spread the word for all my creative guests. We have the power to help them to keep doing what they love. See you next time.